Hello, and welcome to the Ether Podcast. In our second episode of Season 2, we visit with U.S. Air Force Major Christopher James, author of The Cost of Space System Classification, and our special edition of Ether, a journal of strategic air power and space power, dedicated to space power studies and professional military education, which we released in December 2023. Chris is the commander of the 56th Contracting Squadron at Luke Air Force Base in Arizona, supporting the execution of $88 billion in contracts for the Air Force's largest fighter wing. He also serves as the principal business advisor to the wing commander. Chris holds an MBA and was a Schriever Space Scholar at Air Command and Staff College. He is a contracting officer now, but he began his Air Force career as an IBM launch officer in the brisk high plains surrounding Minot, North Dakota. Welcome to the podcast, Chris.
Oh, Dr. Goodrow, thank you so much for having me. I'm honored to be on with you today.
And call me Laura.
Laura, yes, ma'am. Absolutely. No, I'm super excited to be on this one with you.
Good, I'm glad. So first, you're a contracting officer and an Air Force officer with a background in missiles and an MBA. So I'm kind of curious about the background of your interest in space systems classification.
Yes. No. So thank you for the question. And it's funny when I'm thinking on this question right now, I've had nothing but a nonlinear career. It started. So when I commissioned out of ROTC, initially I was slated to be a navigator trainee and be on the flight side of the house, interesting enough. And which that was kind of an ad hoc decision, was never a lifelong dream to fly. It was literally, they came into class one day when we were getting close to assignment notification, said, hey, does this sound interesting? And I said, yep. And I signed up and then got out to flight screening and quickly found out that piloting small aircraft is probably not for me. I think I just could not overcome the physiological effects and, you know, tried as hard as I could. Had really good instructor pilots who kind of put their arm around me and said, hey, everybody sees what you're doing. You're going to be fine. And ended up reclassifying into what was then space and missiles. So as a 13 Sierra. Yep. And it was just, you had talked about the missile time and being up in North Dakota. And that was a really wild time. I came into the ICBM field 2010. That was right after Global Strike stood up as a major command and took all of the nuclear portfolio over. My AFSC, my job series changed the 13 November. So now I'm hard slated as a missileer. That was an awesome, awesome time up there. Great experience. I was able to lead kind of in different positions, assistant flight command, squadron command post positions, instructing out there. Really, really fortunate to have the experience that I did. But that kind of let me at the end, since we transitioned into 13 November, the missile career field is really unique where they're very bottom heavy. They need lots of CGOs, company grade officers, can't really hold so many field grade officers. And so I was basically given a choice at the end to fill out another dream sheet and pick another career field that was in need. It just so happened I was able to transition into contracting. I think I was the only one in my group. I think we had about 20 to 24 of us at that time that transitioned over. So really, really fortunate crossing into contracting. My assignment was out to LA Air Force Base, which again was super fortunate for me. So I mean, not only coming from North Dakota, which I loved, but seasonally, it was nice going to Southern California. And I'm also a Southern California native. And so the stars kind of aligned. Typically, they want you to start in base operational contracts, just try to get the initial feel for commercial type contracting and everything else. And I was able to get into medical services, commodities, some specialized contracting, like professional services that we bring onto base. And that lasted for all of the year because my clearance, my TS clearance, was still active for my missile time. And they, the director, so the Space Superiority Directorate that handles all of the classified or green door portfolio that I know a lot of people are familiar with those terms. They did a search. They were in need of folks who were cleared. And then I got pulled over only after a year of being in operational contracting. And that's really, that was the getting over to Space Superiority. That was the genesis for all of this research, the paper, me wanting to do it. It's kind of a tribute to a lot of those folks that I worked with back there because of the nature of the work. and everybody's reluctance to really talk about what they're doing, just for, you know, any kind of small spillage or whatever it might be. I feel like it gets overlooked easily, just because those folks aren't talking about it. They're not talking about the issues. And so I thought I had a really good opportunity with this research to kind of present it. While I was in Space Superiority, I was able to earn my unlimited warrant as a contracting officer, which was huge. And that was just through the support of my office there. It was great working on all different kinds of programs. I think usually when you're in a space portfolio, you only have a certain segment of it. So if I work in GPS or MilSatCom, I may only have a certain block upgrade that I'm assigned to as a contracting professional. And that's the only segment I would work on because of those are massive, massive programs. And that's kind of what it takes to keep them running. I think on the classified Green Door side, you get exposure to a lot of smaller programs that you can kind of see end to end, in addition to the very large ones. And so I worked with every type of funding, procurement funds, research and development, sustainment or O&M, the 3,400 funds I know a lot of folks are familiar with. I got to work with all those, and my major programs were the counter communication system, the CCS system, and then also geosynchronous space situational awareness program, which a lot of people know as GSAP. Just awesome portfolio, awesome experience. But I, through this research, wanted to bring a lot of things to light. And I think while I was back there, I just grew an appreciation for the space mission. I want to do anything I possibly can to further those missions.
So let's jump into your article, the subject of your research. Yeah. And I think that's neat, the tribute to those folks that in those communities that are not seen much, but work really hard for our national security. So in the article, you talk about three structural factors that inhibit U.S. Space Force systems acquisition process and international partnerships. You know, you talk about FMS, for example. So can you talk a little bit more about that? Walk us through that.
Absolutely. So that first factor, and it's really kind of the genesis to all this and drives every single decision that you'll see that'll kind of come about afterward. But it really comes from the initial decisions that are made at the original classification authority. I think what a lot of folks are, what they've seen in the paper and probably heard elsewhere is OCA authority. That's actually authority delegated down from the president. So it's executive branch focused on the space procurement side of the house. And I learned this just through the research. I thought I understood space procurement at what was then SMC, which is now SSC, but come to find out, we only had a sliver of the entire portfolio when you look across, even the DOD. So this, you know, not even involving the civil agency, it's just what the DOD does. So that delegated authority goes down to 8 heads within just DOD space procurement. So you can think NRO and SDA, Space Development Agency, those types of places. Those decision makers at OCAs have to make classification decisions that fall into 8 different categories that are laid out. It's in an executive order 13526 that I point to in the paper. A whole bunch of different categories in there. And some, it's interesting, some relate to critical infrastructure like water wells and, you know, maybe things that you don't think of on a day-to-day basis, but what keep us running day-to-day life. Another one, I think that really comes into play with space systems is vulnerabilities or capabilities relating to national security. So that, as straightforward as it may sound in some cases, I think that's also very, very, it can be interpreted very, very broadly. And in this is just my opinion through the research that I went through, is that I think that's the category that's leveraged probably most often. If I had to guess with the OCAs when they're looking at making that classification decision. Beyond this point, so you have that initial decision that's made, and that can be the most consequential in some cases. So you can say, you know, due to the nature of the vulnerabilities we may or may not expose here, I think this needs to be at a top secret level or even held beyond that too. So a lot of people have heard about SAP or special access programs, things that further restrict who has access to that data and information. And so you kind of have a full spectrum of decisions to make at that point. That's going to drive everything else. Beyond that initial decision with the OCA, you've got derivative authorities too that exist basically with anybody who has a clearance and is a part of those programs. So they fit into that, you know, they've got a valid need to know their, you know, everything else that a lot of folks are familiar with on the national security side. They have ability to further restrict data as it comes down. And I think that's where we're running into a lot of issues. I know I kind of refer to overclassification, and this question actually came up when I presented the research through the Space Scholars on, isn't overclassification just mislabeling through the derivative process? The answer is yes, and it's one kind of leads to the other. So through that mislabeling, so if an additional restrictive caveat is added to something like a no foreign caveat or whatever it might be, you have now overclassified it beyond its initial intent, and you've caused a whole set of consequences beyond that, you know, that unintended too. I think most of the time, the folks that are working these programs just want to keep the data secure, which is important and things that we need to do, but they're adding these extra layers that cause ripple effects through everything else that they may not be aware of. And so on top of that, on top of the derivative authority piece, those decisions that come down from the OCA also drive how many chefs you have in the kitchen and who is all involved in your program. So when you look at traditional unclassified program, it's typically pretty straightforward. You've got the requirement holders, and then you have your integrated product team, the IPT, that's focused on making that acquisition happen. So that's your program manager, contracting officer as the business lead. You've got your legal expertise, everybody else on there. As soon as you cross into that classified realm, you're also now involving program security offices and offices like OSIPJ, who their focus and attention and their objectives are much different from yours, where for the IPT, they want to make sure that they're acquiring a product that meets everything that the customer needs in a timely fashion, and you stay in budget. So kind of all the essentials of program management, the time, performance, budget, everything else. As soon as the program security offices and OSIPJ are involved, they have different equities that involve protection of that data that could drive your timeline potentially weeks and weeks, because their focus is different. They're focused on the security, and I need to make sure we don't have unintended spills, things of that nature. So totally makes sense. They're just doing their jobs. But those are some of the things that happen as a result of these decisions. On the second structural factor, so that's kind of the first overarching, the high barriers of entry for small business and what we would call, I think in contracting, we refer to as non-traditional defense contractors. And those are a lot of the startups and the small businesses that have not done work with us before, and they don't have experience with the federal acquisition regulation, everything else. And those are the folks that we want to bring them in just to expand that diversity of thought and solutions and everything else. But it's the high barriers that they're faced with getting into this type of work. In general, the federal acquisition regulation mandates that we give small business a preference and priority as much as we possibly can. So it's some of the folks on here who may be listening or might be familiar with the simplified acquisition thresholds, the $250,000 for procurements. We, as a rule, have to seek small business sources for those types of procurements. It's kind of out of the question. It would take certain exceptions to get outside of that. We've got small business set-asides dedicated to specific socioeconomic groups, and got service-disabled veterans, things of that nature, of set-asides that we can give for certain procurements. And then a lot of folks are probably familiar with the rule of two. Anytime we're in source selections, with very few exceptions that sometimes include research and development, if I've identified two small businesses that are capable of delivering what it is we need, then this is now a small business requirement. And so we're really mandated to focus on small business to the greatest extent we can. And the classified environment is very prohibited to that. So with one of the things you're kind of looking at is just the infrastructure. So having to work in a sensitive compartmented information facility or a SCIF. Also a SAP-F is just a more restrictive version of that. You're looking at enormous costs just to kind of enter that realm. And that's before we're even talking the communications infrastructure that's required, because it's different sets of how I communicate through email. It's nowhere near close as what we are used to on the unclassified side. And then secure fax, which I'll talk to you a little about later on. But just different means that encumber communication, add additional costs. And I think kind of the kicker with all of this is that these small businesses and these startups and the folks that we really want to get after these problem sets and give us solutions, they have to make these investments up front, I think is what a lot of people don't understand. They may think, oh, well, they may have a sense of what it is they're going to be bidding for through the proposal process and can plan accordingly, but that is not the case. In order to have access to the level of data they would need to make informed business decisions, so like to see our solicitations and our requirements, they have to possess security clearances for their folks, the infrastructure to communicate. They've already gone through the certification process that I talked about in the paper, that NISPOM process. They've already passed all those gates just to compete. And that is a very, very high barrier of entry for these businesses. So that was just something else that I identified in the paper. A third kind of structural factor would be the lack of automation and tools that a lot of the contracting officers and procurement professionals need just to do their job day to day. And a lot of that is due to the standalone nature of the systems that you have to use in a classified environment. So totally understandable. You don't want to be on linked networks that can be easily attacked or infiltrated. So I think everybody understands that, kind of the need for it. So we absolutely need it. But just because you're working on standalone systems doesn't mean that you have to work these actions individually, or that you can't have some level of automation. So I know I laid it out in the paper, but your contracting officers are executing contracts through Word, which was common on deployments, I think years ago, when you'd be in austere environments and you couldn't get reliable internet connections or whatever it might have been. And so you were doing things manually, which that's just a part of the job. I think at the end of the day, they're going to get things done, but you don't want that as a common practice. I think especially on major, major programs where there's lots of changes, constantly modifications or engineering change plans going into effect, things of that nature. Nobody's perfect. And so you introduce more imperfection into the system by having all of that handwork. Same on the financial side too. So I think a lot of what you see in those programs, just due to the nature of the standalone systems, is that you'll have your contracting officer, your procurement office holding one set of books on Excel, the program office on their side, because they're tracking overall budget and everything else, they have their set of books through Excel. And then you also have the contractor, because they've got to make sure they have their set with their finance folks. And so what could go wrong with three sets of books that get matched all together? And so I think it just kind of goes back to no person, no office is ever going to be perfect. And you just kind of introduce more issues, not having the same level of automation that we have on the unclassified side. You know, I mentioned secured fax earlier. You're also getting into the use of infrastructure. Like if I'm trying to send a proposal, it could take days to weeks in some cases, because I need to have someone certified on the sending end and the receiving end to get those papers. And who knows how long that can take. And I think one thing they're also really limited on the contracting side, and we're talking tools and everything else, is I don't have a firm grasp of my market as much as I would on the unclassified side. If I'm working an unclass effort, I can very easily go out to a SAM.gov or many other venues to send out requests for information and really figure out who's in the marketplace, who has things to provide. That's, which rightfully so, because communication's got to be monitored and restricted and limited, but it really kind of makes it impossible to get a full grasp of who has the solutions you need, just because who you can communicate with is oftentimes limited to a list that's provided from your security manager, who says, hey, here's the folks who have these caveats or classifications you need. And there are very, very limited avenues to bring new contractors, new small businesses in and get a sense of what they're doing capability wise. Those are kind of the main structural factors that really inhibit the acquisition of space systems from what I saw in the research.
So the system itself sort of preferences longstanding players in the system and naturally restricts, you know, as you said, newcomers, and like you've noted in the article, and stymies innovation too.
Right.
So now that we've seen the challenges, which there are many, and some of the concerns, as you note, are not solvable, but you offer three courses of action to address some of these challenges and kind of maybe figure out a better way forward that would benefit the government and industry and, you know, taxpayers, I think, you know, because you save money by kind of reaching out. So tell us more about your COAs for this.
And you're right. We won't be able to solve absolutely everything, which is unfortunate. And I think tries we might. And I know I've seen a lot of good progress in that direction that I can talk about in a bit. But for my course of action, just kind of looking through the problem set and really thinking about it through my time while I was in space superiority, because I think hopefully it came across in the writing, but a lot of this I'd been sitting on for a really long time, trying to figure out how do we get to an ideal state in terms of competition and getting those innovative ideas? I know one thing I didn't mention previously is that right around the time I was in Space Priority Directorate, OT is the other transactional authorities, or OTAs, that a lot of people have heard of. Those were codified in the federal acquisition regulations as I was in the directorate. So I think it was right around 2015. And it was authorities that we had on a test basis and by exemption basis for the DoD, but it was something NASA had access to for decades. And so it was great to kind of see that finally become formal and come to fruition. And I think that's really what got me thinking on a lot of the ways to get after these challenges, where it's like, gosh, we just formalized this process. I now have a way to contract outside of the federal acquisition regulation to actually get ideas on white papers for research and development or start initial production, things like that. And so we weren't able to get to all the answers we needed while I was there, because that was kind of the start of the OT process, but awesome to see. For some of the courses of action I addressed, just from the very top, something that we as a government, and probably more so executive branch and DoD, can get after is changes in policy that would give our OCAs more levers to pull on the classification decisions that they're making. So kind of at a top line, I said that it would be beneficial to have the OCAs advised by procurement professionals. So it could be folks with contracting experience or lots of like general program experience that have worked in Green Door or classified positions and really have a full understanding of what these decisions mean at a programmatic level and kind of what they drive and what they force. Not to say that an advisor is going to solve absolutely everything, but I see equal benefit in the OCA being advised by those folks as to the operators that I'm sure that they will also have in the room, who are giving the operational take on why this data needs to be protected, why these capabilities need to be protected or not, or is there a way to not have this classified so we're providing a deterrent so our enemies are aware of what we have, it's an intentional thing, things of that nature. So I think that level of advisement is super, super important. And one thing that I talked about in that vein is changes to security classification guides and program classification guides. That really kind of gets down into the nuts and bolts of how the data is handled at the programmatic level for all of these different offices and what terms are classified. Can you associate dollar amounts? Can this word be used with this word? Like really, really detail-oriented things. Changes in those guides would really help enable the OCA to make better decisions on the classification piece too. So what they could do at that OCA level is instead of going to the full maximum or the highest restriction possible, they could keep things at kind of a more moderate level to say, hey, this protection still needs to be guarded. Maybe I can just keep it at a secret, or if this needs to be top secret, I can keep it at that level. And then if I need to enter into special access programs, those SAP controls, I can enable my folks who are down levels from me to make those decisions through those guides, giving them that authority or other DoD policy authority. So, and what I'm thinking in that case is as a capability, if it's saying it's a brand new capability, as it's getting closer to initial operational capability or IOC, then the leads on those programs can make the decision on, you know what, I think we need special access program controls on this because the capability is far greater than what we thought, or we've reached this point and it's, you know what, we don't need those types of controls. And so I think that will help make the OCA make better decisions in the long run, where they won't be so concerned on, I have to go to the maximum because there's a lot of unknowns and what if I make a mistake and, you know, it's safer to just over-classify or, you know, whatever it might be to try to get away from that. I think going downstream from there too, when I was talking the derivative classification authority that we all have, everybody who is read in and has a need to know and is briefed in those programs, leveraging machine learning. I know, I think in my paper, I was talking things like Grammarly and using those types of programs that can kind of identify, hey, did you actually want this word and things of that nature. I could see machine learning having a major impact on the derivative side because it's, I think, day to day, you're kind of, you know, you're sending emails, you're sending a lot of those different types of communication, and that would help a whole lot with something going out that didn't need to be no foreign, and maybe it did go without that tool. It would make a tremendous impact on the day-to-day too. So being able to be assisted through technology that we already have and making sure that we're not over-classifying or mislabeling things when we don't need to. Another course of action that I talked about in the paper was lowering those barriers to entry. I know that's kind of right in line with what, hey, these barriers to entry are too high, let's lower them. Kind of at a baseline, and this gets into more administrative process type things, but they make a huge impact. So a lot of folks might think, hey, this is just paperwork processing, what's the big deal? It's a huge deal on the classification side. So that DD254 on the contract end, that's our security classification specification. So that's what we attach to contracts that support programs that are classified. And it basically lays out, here's what those are, and here's how to gain access and everything else. And here's what's required to maintain data and all that kind of stuff. A rule change was made in 2019. Actually, it's a regulation change that said we're not doing paper tracking on that anymore because it is just, it's too cumbersome. It's insane. Things get lost, this and that. But due to issues with software and connectivity and everything else, the electronic tracking, I know at the time I was in a space priority, was not where it needed to be. And it's, I think it's really just ensuring that the programs stay on top of that too. So it's, hey, let's get after the low hanging fruit and make sure this is all tracked electronically. We're not losing things, because that ultimately impacts our certification for our contractors. So their clearance certification that they need, what they need to get their folks individual clearances. And if you're talking slowdowns on what seems like administrivia paperwork type stuff, that could lead to months of backlog and delay and everything else. So I think it's getting after those things. And it's also working with the certification entities and offices like OPM who are making the determinations on security clearances and figuring out a way to prioritize certain missions too. So I think that was another issue we saw, that you would have these incredible backlogs of contractors waiting to get their clearances finally adjudicated through the system. And while I wasn't privy to the decisions made on the OPM side, the investigation side, and there's a whole lot that goes into those decisions, it also seemed to me that there wasn't a prioritization put into that process. And so if everything's priority, nothing's a priority, we need to figure out some kind of way to stratify these missions to say, hey, these folks and these programs and these contracts need to be at the front of the line when we're talking getting people through the security clearance process and things of that nature. I think another thing that would also help greatly when we're talking about small business and our startups getting into this space and not having existing infrastructure, one way we can really get after that is through small business participation. And what a lot of folks may not know, if they haven't been a part of a major source selection or source selection in general, is that that's actually an evaluatable element in our DoD source selection procedures. So I can, as a contracting officer, assign more weight to small business participation than I would say past performance, or equal to past performance, cost considerations, technical considerations, things of that nature. Usually from my personal experience, I can't talk like recent experience, but my personal past experience, small business participation was just more of a comply, non-comply type step, as opposed to something that we would give significant weight to. And a lot of it was because it was a brand new category that had emerged from the rewrite in the DoD source selection procedures. And so I think if we're really serious about getting new entrants into the field, getting a broader diversity of thought, if we put more emphasis on that small business participation and really incentivizing our current cleared prime contractors to just swing for the fences and get as much participation as they can, that'll pay huge dividends, because that means that those small businesses and the startups we don't normally do business with, they can get their folks cleared. So they've got valid need to that type of data. That also gives them the opportunity to generate money. So working as a subcontractor, of course, and to reinvest that into SCIF secured infrastructure that will put them on the path to compete as a prime contractor and not just as a sub. And so I think if we're really serious about getting after that, that's something that we can work right now. And I did interviews with contracting officers who work in these types of programs, like out at SSC, and kind of got their input on, you know, hey, what are you seeing? And does any of it align with some of the experiences that I had, things of that nature? And one of them had offered up that aside from wanting to bring in these small businesses and non-traditional contractors, which is great, and that's going to increase competition and diversity of thought and get us to better solution sets, is that we really need to work to preserve our current prime contractors and the infrastructure they have on the classified side. So not to say that we're responsible to shore up these major large businesses that we've been working with for decades. That's not really it. It's the recommendation was, hey, is there some way we can get NDAA language in where we can offer incentives for them, specifically keep classified structure that would also help keep their workforces intact? Because what they're seeing, and really it was a consequence of the pandemic, is that telework and remote work options skyrocketed, which is overall a good thing. So this is my personal opinion now, a good thing, especially in our line of work. For contracting, I have to be able to execute from anywhere across the world at any given time. And all of the increases we saw in VPN capability and everything else, all phenomenal. It also caused major issues with these primes who rely on having skilled personnel in-house with clearances. You can't telework this type of thing. Just one piece is on the collaboration side. When you're talking R&D efforts, it helps to have those folks like in the seat talking together, all the different offices kind of coming together to collaborate. But you cannot on a remote basis do this type of work just due to the nature of the restrictions and everything else. And so that was something that contracting officer, that feedback I got, I thought it was really insightful too, but it was kind of like, hey, yes, we need to get after these new entrants. We have to also protect the defense infrastructure we have in place now that supports it. Another course of action that I'd offered up, and I was alluding to it just previously, but it was expanding tools for our procurement experts too, and the contracting officers. So getting classified version of our contract writing software, ConIT, I think some folks might be familiar with. Interesting side story, it was actually software that we gained from the Department of Agriculture. It was something, it was a system that they had in place for a while that works great. And it does. It works awesome on the unclassified side. It streamlines all kinds of different things on, you know, when you're talking procure to pay and everything else. Getting a version that can operate on standalone machines, which I will say for all the listeners too, that has been identified as something that needs to happen kind of through bigger Air Force and Air Force contracting, kind of where we're centralized at SAF, as something that needs to happen. It just hasn't been fully implemented yet. And a lot of that is because the bulk of the work is unclassified, and we'll get to the classified side when we can, but that absolutely needs to happen. It's getting that automation is going to reduce a lot of the common mistakes that we see and just make things faster. I think overall, we also need to give the contracting officers an ability to really get the type of market research that they need and fully understanding the industry base that can support them. I know one thing in the paper I talked about was a CRADA, the Cooperative Research and Development Agreement, that are usually a part of the programmatic side. So it's typically your program offices who have identified academic institutions and it can also be contractors in some cases, but organizations where we don't have a formal contract, like a contracted relationship with them, but we've identified a need to work with them on the research end. And that opens up a lot of different possibilities too. So since we've established this agreement and we've identified that both parties mutually benefit, that also means that I can get those folks under the CRADA. I can get them security clearances. I can get them kind of read into what our initial requirements are and give them insight on the important factors that will inform their business decisions on, hey, is this something that we can really tap into and work that we eventually want to really compete for? Or is this not for us? We need to focus on different things. Giving the contracting officers authorities like CRADAs would be huge. You can identify at a preliminary basis companies and startups that would potentially fit well into what you need and kind of get that process started on identifying folks, kind of doing initial background and getting them approved to a level that will give them insight they need to make informed business decisions, essentially. So I think giving the contracting officers that authority would really be game changing. And those are some of the main courses of action that I focused on in the work.
Well, obviously not a simple problem, and so many challenges, especially there'd be challenges if it weren't dealing with classified, but because it are, it's like just magnifies it. And what you've identified are things that if fixed, from my perspective as a former analyst, some of those things could be applicable across fields. So that's great information. If you have any closing thoughts.
Absolutely. So the point you just made is that these issues, I know they pervade the DoD. So I know my focus and my experience was based on work I was doing, which now falls under Space Force, but the space procurement side. But I know this honestly cuts across the whole DoD. And so hopefully me getting this out just helps drive those discussions within all those different agencies. What I will say for the folks that are working in those acquisition offices, trying to inform their bosses on courses of action or at the OCA level too, classified does not mean faster. I'm not going to name names, but I've heard I was privy to or part of discussions where that was brought up in the initial formation of requirements on, hey, let's make this classified. That's going to cut out a whole bunch of stuff, maybe competition wise and everything else, and this will go faster. And that could not be farther from the truth. And I could go on and on about examples on how I can move much faster if we never classified that. But just something to look out for, I think, as practitioners are kind of going along. If you hear stuff like that, that needs to be a stopgate, and you need to have more informed discussions on what that means actually. Because of the nature of the work, I know I addressed it from the top. A lot of folks, they're going to want to default to stay quiet on these types of issues just because they don't want to say something they're not supposed to and whatever else. And so I would just ask that decision makers kind of be cognizant of that. Maybe look for ways to pull out that information through discussion. Super important. I alluded to it previously. I think things are moving in the right direction. I had a friend send me an article that came out. It was on the 17th of January. So really recently, I think it was C4ISRNet did the reporting on it. Ironically, so it was a change in the Pentagon classification policy, but then I saw that the policy itself was actually classified. I thought that was kind of funny, but
I saw that
the synopsis of the changes. Yeah. And that was very, very positive development.
Yeah.
I know I definitely had nothing to do with it because I know all my stuff was just published in December, but
it was
really good to see. Yeah, right. Yeah, right. Some one-off discussion somewhere. I'll take the credit. The credit all day but really good movement in that direction. And I think kind of what I'll end with is that for the folks with the derivative authority and the OCAs and kind of everybody in between, please do not default to the maximum classification of whatever it might be you're working on and think that you're helping. I think that was one of the big things that came out of the 9/11 commission that I cited in the paper too, was that basically since the Cold War, the default was to let's slap the maximum classification. I'm protecting everybody. I'm protecting programs. We've got to get away from that. The mindset has got to change. So only if this is absolutely necessary.
Yep. I agree. Well, thank you, Chris. I appreciate you joining us on the podcast, and I commend folks to his article, The Cost of Space System Classification, in our special edition of Ether published last month. And again, thank you for joining me on the podcast. I really had a great conversation.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Laura. I really appreciate it.